cycles, testing different voltages and amperages. But each time, all they succeeded in doing, if the tissue reacted at all, was frying the cells within the plate. "Something isn't right," Kate said, after running through another exhaustive experiment. "We're missing a key component. Not a single tissue has formed a webbing of any kind. And in fact, they all seem to be reacting negatively to the external stimuli." "I must admit I'm completely stumped," Carr said. Kate stared at the last plastic plate full of barbecued tissue. The tiny cells held so many secrets, and still she couldn't unveil them. With Team Ghost in the field, and the threat of more raider and variant attacks looming over her, she knew she didn't have the luxury of time now. She had to solve this mystery. Slowly or quickly, it had to be done. The question was how. Fisher had spent much of the day out in the field, sweating away with his men on their hunt for the variants. He had come back for supper to find breaking news on his laptop. Having internet access had cost him a hell of a lot of money, but being up to date on things going on across the country was worth every penny. The attempted attack at the New America Coalition rally in Outpost New Boston was shocking, even with the other attacks on safe zone outposts. The thwarted assassination attempt in plain daylight was the most brazen thing he had seen in a while. Such an incident proved to Fisher yet again that President Ringgold and Vice President Lemke did not even have their own security under control. If collaborators could sneak into an event like that, Fisher wasn't sure there was any safe place left in the country. At least, not under the leadership of the New America Coalition. He closed his laptop and grabbed a cigar. Moving over to the windows, he glanced out at the star-filled night sky. In a strange way, he was surprised that out in his little corner of Texas, it looked just as pretty tonight as all those nights before the Great War of Extinction. Back then, he didn't have to compete with the light pollution of a big city clotting his view of the Big Dipper and all the other constellations swirling above. Now he didn't have to compete with anything at all. It was just him, Mother Nature, and the monsters. He lit his cigar and took the first pull as several pickup trucks drove away from the compound, their lights chasing away the darkness. Chase and Tran were heading out with Sergeant Sharp to use the infrared scanners, now that it was dark, in one last attempt to locate the monsters. All the money he'd paid for good intel on the variant's whereabouts might as well have been burned in an open field. The pesky fuckers seemed to have abandoned ship. Fisher Fields had lost enough guards and workers to the beasts, not to mention costly equipment. All of it had set back their operations considerably. Fisher blew out a puff of smoke, hoping that maybe those creatures were smart enough to know he was hunting them now, that maybe they'd run for their lives. But that was probably being too optimistic. Optimism had never served him nor his fields well. Realism was much better. "Hope for the best, prepare for the worst," he thought. That was why he was skipping whiskey with his cigar tonight. Until his teams returned with an all clear, he wasn't going to crack open a bottle. The variants were as sneaky as they were deadly, and he wasn't going to assume that they'd simply run off without a fight. A knock on his door sounded, and he turned to see Maddie holding a plate and a glass of water. The 50-year-old housekeeper doubled as a cook, maid, and friend. She had taken damn good care of him over the past 2 years.
"Good evening, Mr. Fisher," she said. "Would you like to eat in here or in the dining room?"
Fisher gestured toward his desk.
"I'll eat in here tonight. Thank you, Maddie."
He almost always ate at his desk when he didn't have company. Sitting in the large dining room by himself was damn depressing and reminded him of how much he missed his wife. Maddie set the food down and he took a seat at his desk.
"Thanks,"
he said again. She nodded and closed the door behind her quietly. Although he didn't feel much like eating tonight, he dug into the warm meal of mashed potatoes and broiled chicken. Food wasn't just for pleasure, it was for fuel. And if he had variants to deal with, he was going to need a hell of a lot of fuel to keep him fighting. He continued reading more reports on attacks at other outposts as he chewed.
"Holy shit," he whispered.
By the time he finished eating, he had read about another 6 attacks. He stood and looked outside.
What the hell is happening out there?
He took his plate back to the kitchen and set it in the sink.
Thank you, he said to Maddie, who was washing the rest of the dishes.
You're welcome, sir.
The news of the variants had him on edge. He took another cigar out from his humidor and looked out the window. A carpet of moonlight spread over the fields and the livestock barns on the eastern edge of his property. Opening the window, he lit the cigar and took a deep inhale. Then he blew the smoke outward. The breeze rustled his sweat-stained fatigues. Crickets chirped outside, their calls rising into a steady chorus. He loved that sound. Fisher took a seat in his leather recliner, putting his feet up, when the insects were silenced by a gunshot. He froze. Two more gunshots pierced the night. Something was wrong. A siren blared from the guard post on the south side of the property. He got out of his chair and walked to the windows holding the smoking cigar. The radio on his desk crackled behind him.
Mr. Fisher, this is Tran. Do you copy?
What the Sam Hill is going on?
Fisher replied.
Where are you, sir?
In my goddamn office. What's going on?
You need to get to the bunker as soon as possible, Tran said.
We think we found the variant, sir.
Before Fisher could reply, Tran added,
they were underground all along.
Underground?
Where?
Here, sir. The guards at the livestock barns were the ones who reported it, and now they aren't responding.
Turn on the floodlights, Fisher said.
The lights clicked on one at a time, and Fisher's cigar fell from his mouth at the sight of a fight. No. A slaughter. Dozens of variants streamed out of a broken-down side door in one barn, chasing cows into the grass. The screams of the livestock filled the night as the monsters tore them to pieces and fed on their fattened flesh. Other beasts ripped apart the guards that had been patrolling outside. The men hadn't expected an attack to occur from within the barns and were completely unprepared. A man was retreating into the eastern corner of the electric fences. He backed up, trying to reload his rifle.
Oh my God,
Fisher whispered. A variant dropped to all fours and bolted after him. The man climbed the barbed wire fence. He managed to get over the top, but so did the variant. With nowhere to go, the soldier chose the electric fence over Claws. It fried him and sent him flying backward into the livestock fence. The beast dug in on the smoking flesh.
Sir, we're almost back, Tran said on the radio. If you're not in the bunker, you need to go now.
Fisher smelled smoke and looked down, seeing the cigar had burned into the carpet. He picked it up and smothered it into a glass ashtray. Then he hurried over to grab his M4. He slung it over his back and then went to his cabinet. Opening the doors, he pulled out his Remington 3200 double-barreled 12-gauge. With his .357 already holstered, he was ready to go. Two pickup trucks pulled up outside, skidding to a stop. Men jumped out and fired at the beasts around the barns.
Son of a bitch, Fisher said.
He hurried out of his office and into the hallway.
Maddie, he yelled.
The woman stumbled into the hallway.
Sir, those things are out there. Grab the rest of the staff and take them to the bunker right now.
She nodded and took off down the hallway toward the basement. The bunker there was built to survive a chemical, biological, or nuclear attack. There was enough food and water for his whole staff to live on for a year or more. Fisher had spent almost a year inside it when the variants had first overwhelmed the country, and he didn't like the idea of returning to it now. Halfway down the hall, Maddie stopped and turned.
"Aren't you coming?"
she said. He plucked another cigar out of his breast pocket.
"I'm not coming," Fisher said. "I've got some unfinished business with these bastards."
"But, sir," she called out, "go to the bunker, and don't come out until you're giving the all clear,"
he yelled over his shoulder. He took off in the direction of the gunfire. The wail of the siren, chatter of automatic weapons, and pop of small arms reminded him of the first days of the Great War of Extinction. He promised himself if this happened again, he wouldn't run and hide. If he was to die, he wanted to do it standing up, not crouching like a coward. Bringing up his shotgun, he ran through the living room and to the back doors. He opened it with one hand and stepped outside on the deck, his ears assaulted by the sounds of battle.
"Sir, what are you doing?" someone called out.
Chase ran up the wood steps, his baseball cap splattered with blood. Tran was right behind him, his biceps slashed open. The rest of the men were still holding position near the pickups. "Mr. Fisher, we need to get to the bunker," Tran said. "There are too many of them." "And leave these men and my livestock out here to die?" "Hell no," Fisher said. He moved over to the railing of the deck and set his shotgun against the side. Then he unslung his M4 and palmed in a magazine. "Fall back," he shouted. "Everyone fall back to the deck." Tran and Chase both reloaded their weapons, trying to convince him to change his mind, but nothing they could say would work. The other men all ran up the steps and joined them on the deck. Fisher lined up his scope and zoomed in on the closest fenced-off area, about 1,400 feet away. It was quite the distance, but he was a good shot, and there were enough targets he figured he would hit something. He centered the sights on a beast with its maw buried in the belly of a squirming cow. He pulled the trigger, firing off a burst. One of the rounds found a home in the creature's neck. The monster skittered away a few feet and then crashed to the ground limp. Two other variants tried to drag a calf away. Fisher killed one with a headshot and then aimed for the other beast, trying to get a clear shot. He found it a beat later and pulled the trigger. The second variant slumped to the ground and the calf pushed itself up and huddled behind another cow. Fisher sighted up a third creature and brought it down with a shot to the leg. He finished it with shots to the back and side. The men next to him took down several more, but the rest of the variants ripping his men and livestock apart behind the first barn were too far to hit. The beasts retreated back into the barn with their kills. Several more shots rang out from the men around him, but they became more sporadic until finally stopping. After a few seconds, the only noise was that of the wailing siren. "Shut the thing off," Fisher said. Tran brought up his radio and called their command post. The noise rose and fell one last time. Fisher brought the scope to his eye and zoomed in on the distant fences, seeing the variants had also retreated in those areas. Soon the screams of the massacred animals and men went quiet, and the chirp of the crickets resumed. "Anyone got eyes on those shits?" Fisher continued to scan the area. Everyone reported they saw nothing. "Think they went back underground?" Chase asked. "We'll have to send a couple scouts to find out," Tran replied. "Where's everyone else?" Fisher said, looking around. He didn't see Sergeant Sharp or any of his soldiers. He didn't see his trackers, Galinsky or Welling, either. "They went to help put the fires out," Tran said. "The variants attacked several of the derricks, too."
"And you didn't think to mention that earlier?" Fisher said with an angry snort.
"I'm sorry, sir, but my goal was to make sure you were safe," Tran said. Chase nodded. "We figured Sharp had that under control."
"I highly doubt that," Fisher stated.
He didn't want to believe it, but there had to be another Alpha out there. Something smart enough to have coordinated this multi-location attack. He cursed through gritted teeth, trying to think of what to do. The livestock were obviously lost, but maybe he could still save the derricks. One thing was certain. If he didn't do something, Fisher Fields wasn't going to make it through the night. 18. Dohai had spent the better part of the night slowly working his way toward Gold Medal Park in Minneapolis with Rico. The last report from Mendez confirmed he was still holed up in the condo. But now Dohai was starting to worry. He hadn't heard anything from Team Alpha either. They were supposed to be working their way across the other side of the city to the University of Minneapolis. The good news was the team had prepared to be out here for at least 2 or 3 days. As long as they didn't go beyond that, they would be fine. He took a drink of water and followed Rico through a burned-out pub with exposed brick walls. Charcoal stools and tables littered the floor. Shards from broken bottles and the bar mirror hid under the debris, making each step dangerous. Progress just to get to the pub had been painfully slow. They had taken a detour much further south than Dohai would have liked before they had headed north again. Prowling variants had forced them inside. Even from their hidden location, he could hear their clicking joints and howls as they hunted. Dohai tried to drown out the noises and the smells. The rotten fruit odor wasn't the only thing contributing to the malodorous, bombed-out city. Mold climbed up the walls from puddles of stagnant water along the floor. In the back of the bar, a refrigerator lay open, its contents a mess of black fur and spiky growths. Crumpled beer cans were adhered to the floor in sticky piles of unrecognizable brown gunk. At Rico's command, Dohai positioned himself near a back door and snapped his night vision goggles back on. According to his map, this exit led to an alley. The main thoroughfares were too dangerous, and Bravo hoped to avoid some of those monsters by creeping along in the shadows instead as they made their way to Mendez. Rico shouldered her M4A1 and gave him a nod. Dohai wrapped his gloved hand around the handle and twisted it, pushing the door open a couple of inches. Distant growls of variants filtered in, but none sounded close. He waited there to be sure, counting the passing seconds, not making another move. Just peering into the darkness outside with his NVGs, studying the green and white sliver of alley. Shadows moved in the street beyond the carcasses of cars and trucks. Dohai signaled to Rico and she gestured back for him to exit. He eased the door open further and stepped into the alley, clearing both sides before signaling for Rico to follow. She moved, and they navigated the scree from devastated buildings side by side. A cool wind cut into them, and another distant variant howled. More of the beasts answered the call, the shrieks rising into the night like a flock of birds taking to the air. Every hair on the back of his neck stood straight. A single mistake would bring the hordes on them. There was no way he and Rico could survive that. He swallowed his fear and pushed on, squeezing between an overturned dumpster and a brick wall. Scattered bones lay on the other side, blackened and broken. Once he got to the end of the alley, he knelt behind the bumper of a car that had slammed into a nearby wall. Inside the front seat sat a picked-over skeleton. All around him came the scrapes and scratches of other beasts searching the picked-through graveyard. Most of the creatures were starving and desperate, which made them even more dangerous. Rico pointed at a rusted Humvee. It took him a moment to spot the variant. It crouched nearby, angling a wart-covered nose in the air. Dohai rotated so he had the creature in his sights. A suppressed shot now would rupture the silence of the night unless it was timed with a howl. If not, it would draw every variant within the neighboring blocks on his position. He waited, hoping that it would simply go on wandering listlessly into the night. But he had no such luck. The creature seemed to catch a whiff of something and dropped to all fours. He moved his finger to the trigger, waiting for a shriek or howl to mask his shot. The creature bounded across, and he prepared to squeeze the trigger, but the variant seemed to drop through the street. Dohai eased off the trigger. It took a moment for him to realize what had happened. There was an open manhole in the middle of the street. From there, an animalistic cry exploded. The clicking of joints grew louder, and other cries from variants responded. The starving, filthy beasts began to pour out of shops and skitter down the sides of buildings. Others leapt from broken windows. They rocked into each other as they stormed toward the open manhole. One by one, they squeezed into the hole, vanishing into the darkness. All Dohai and Rico could do was press themselves against the wall, shrinking behind the car, while the stampede rattled the ground. It might have only lasted a minute, but to Dohai, it felt like an eternity. Eventually, the last of the beasts made it into the underground hell. Dohai made a mental note of their position. Once he made sure their path ahead was clear, he led Rico away. They began winding their way over the sidewalk, avoiding other corpses and ducking between crashed vehicles. The area had been hit hard. Most of the buildings were nothing but husks or crushed piles of debris. But there was still one building standing. U.S. Bank Stadium towered over the block in the distance, standing between them and Mendez. Jagged panes of black, grime-covered glass stood around the top of the once-enclosed stadium. The roof had been entirely blown away, and chunks of melted scaffolding jutted down from the opening. A low moan seemed to radiate out of the stadium like the building was groaning in pain. Dohai balled his fist and listened. The sounds definitely seemed to be coming from inside the stadium.
"Sounds like people," Rico said quietly.
Images of the tunnels and outpost Turkey River surfaced in his mind. These sounds were all too familiar. One din of countless voices blended together in a macabre soup. the cries from people who were in so much pain they would beg for death. Rico set off toward the rusted cars, buses, and military trucks in the parking lot. The moaning grew louder, almost as if they were approaching a waterfall in the jungle. On the other side of the abandoned vehicles was a quarantine and evacuation checkpoint. Decaying fabric still flapped from huge, collapsed tent poles. The canvas on the rusted cots in the lot had mostly rotted away, and boxes of military first aid supplies lay on their sides, their contents long since raided. Dohai snuck through the area until he reached one of the wide-open gates of the stadium. Rico joined him, roving her rifle back and forth for contacts. Once inside, they crept between piles of debris littering the corridors. Dohai imagined what it had once looked like, with vendors selling cold beers and hot dogs in the wide hall. He could almost smell the popcorn and peanuts in the air, and hear the cheerful chatter of throngs heading for a Vikings game. Now the place was anything but celebratory. Gloom filled the dark passages. Long, dark stains painted the walls. Everywhere Dohai looked was another sign that the civilization he had grown up in no longer existed. The groans and moaning became louder. Rico motioned for Dohai to hurry up. They prowled upstairs that would take them to the seats overlooking the arena floor. Near the top, a sudden clink of talons against concrete sent them both ducking into the shadows. Pale flesh from a variant streaked past. Dohai slipped into a stairwell and took it to the entrance of a seating area marked 211. He stopped in the open corridor, the moaning echoing off the walls. Rico took point and crouched at the end. Dohai followed her, heart flipping when he got a view of the field. Much of the roof had caved in, dumping bent scaffolding onto the football field. Holes leading to underground tunnels littered the place like oversized ant colonies, and flowing from the black lips of earth were dozens of variants. They used the scaffolding that had fallen from the roof into the center of the stadium as a ladder to move around the stadium. Red webbing covered the metal platforms. Those pulsating vines stretched out of the network of tunnels and straight up to the scaffolding. Humans, consumed by the growths, hung from the spider web of metal. Dohai zoomed in with his rifle at webbing growing from eye sockets, open mouths, and virtually every orifice of their bodies. Most of the people appeared to be utterly desiccated, looking like browned and leathery mummies. But others retained some color to their skin. They were still breathing, and writhing ever so slightly. Alphas like the one he'd seen in the tunnels climbed up the network, their tendrils dragging along the organic cables. They pawed at the humans, opening up new wounds. Red webbing extended from the wounds of the weaker-looking prisoners. Dohai swallowed the bile climbing in his throat and knelt behind the seats, trying not to throw up. This was Outpost Turkey River all over again. Only worse. The nightmarish tableau had him wanting to hide. A tap on his shoulder brought him back to attention. Rico pointed to the top of his helmet, and he nodded back. They stood to capture the scene with their cameras. Dohai raked his back and forth to get a sweeping view of the place before they retreated to the outer corridors. The hallway around the stadium's perimeter took them to the north side, where they would continue on to find Mendez. As much as Dohai knew he needed to focus on the path ahead, he couldn't get the sounds or images out of his mind. They were like tattoos seared in his thoughts. "We will save them," Dohai thought, trying to reassure himself. But in his heart, he knew most of those people were beyond saving. Bombing the stadium would have been more merciful than unhooking them from the network of red webbing. He finally managed to get his wits and made it to the north side of the stadium without encountering any of the beasts. Only a block or so separated them from the condo building Mendez was waiting inside. Thinking of his brother did help Dohai refocus from what he had just seen, but with every step away from the stadium, he felt like a magnet was tugging on his bones. There was no denying the connection he felt to this place. While it was probably just in his mind, he couldn't help but feel like he was a prisoner to the nightmarish webbing, just like the people in the stadium. Rico suddenly yanked on his arm and pulled him behind a car. As soon as they ducked down, Dohai saw why. An army of monsters were huddled down on the next block, surrounding what had to be a fresh kill. He zoomed in with his rifle, his heart thumping at the possibility it was Mendez. The body of several humans came into view through the mass of diseased flesh. From what little clothing these people still had on, he could tell they weren't soldiers. Probably more of the prisoners that these variants had plucked from the webbing. He was surprised he hadn't seen more of this. The variants swarmed, fighting over the scraps, and tore the three humans apart frantically. Screeches sounded over the squawking beasts, but they weren't coming from down the street. Dohai glanced over his shoulder. "Oh, shit," he mumbled. Rico turned to see what had him spooked. Hundreds of variants flooded out of the stadium and around the quarantine area. Their numbers were so great, the ground rumbled beneath them, their clawed hands pounding the cracked concrete.
"We have to find cover," Rico whispered.
Dohai nodded and followed her toward the closest building. They ducked inside and moved behind the booth of an old pub. The stampede grew louder, and he poked his head up for a glimpse of the beasts, freezing when he saw their armored flesh. The sight of these monsters sparked a memory. These were no ordinary variants. These were juveniles, a new generation of monsters. But how was that possible? There had been no reports or sightings of more than a few juveniles over the years. "Hell," he whispered. Rico pulled on him, and keeping low, they bolted for a bathroom while the ground vibrated from the heavy armored feet of juvenile variants.
"What did you see?" she whispered.
Dohai shook his head. This nightmare kept getting worse. Seeing the offspring of the monsters meant the beasts were doing something no one believed they were still capable of doing. Breeding, on a mass scale.
"Dohai," Rico whispered.
"Juveniles," he said. "Those were all juveniles."
Rico's jaw hung open.
"You're sure?"
He nodded.
"Should we break radio silence and tell Fitz?"
"He probably already knows," Rico said.
She pulled the gum off her helmet and plopped it in her mouth, chewing as the tiles rumbled under her boots.
"Mendez isn't the only one that needs rescuing now," she whispered.
"We're screwed too."
President Ringgold changed her mind about their destination as she boarded Marine One from Boston to the Greenbrier. "Take us to Peaks Island instead," she ordered. COS Soprano gave her a confused look, but he knew better than to argue after almost 8 years of service. The Secret Service agents, however, protested the change, saying it would be too difficult to secure the area in time.
"I think we're good," Beckham said. "We have Lieutenant Niven and the Iron Hogs on the ground. They'll make sure the LZ is secured."
The lead Secret Service agent approved the plan after Ringgold agreed to call in a second team of Marines, and the VH-60N White Hawk helicopter took off for the island. After the events in Boston, Ringgold wanted to see some friendly faces and learn more about the work being done in the lab there. If anyone could figure out what kind of strange biological phenomena were taking place in those tunnels, it was Kate Lovato. Ringgold tried to relax on the flight, but her mind and heart were with the men and women on dangerous missions across the country. In 6 major cities, teams had deployed to gather intel, and if history repeated itself, many of them would not come back. She prayed for their safe return. All of the men and women had the skills and experience to accomplish their goals, but she couldn't shake the worry that she'd sent them on a suicide mission. The pilots received the all-clear at a few minutes past 11 in the evening. They'd been hovering off the shore at Peaks Island, and now Marine One lowered from the sky. A few minutes later, they touched down in an open field. Ringgold looked outside to see the silhouetted Marines had formed a perimeter. There were probably more prone in the weeds and in the tree line, their sniper rifles ready to fire on any threats. Beckham hopped out first, and then offered his prosthetic hand to her. She took it, and keeping low, followed him and the rest of her team across the grassy field. Several Humvees waited for them. Ringgold climbed in one with Beckham and 3 Secret Service agents. The convoy tore down a dirt road toward the healthcare center that doubled as a bunker and a lab. If she recalled correctly, this was where the raiders had concentrated their attack.
"The facilities survived?" Ringgold asked.
"Mostly," Beckham replied.
All the supplies we lost were replaced, but we can't replace the lives we lost. Jake Temper died trying to protect people there.
I'm sorry, Reed, Ringgold said. She had met the New York police officer and his son Timothy a handful of times. Her heart hurt just thinking about all the deaths in the past week. In the past, heartbreak had proved to be good motivation, but her aging heart couldn't shatter much more without giving out entirely.
This is it, said the driver. He parked the vehicle outside the health center, and a group of Marines fanned out to form a new perimeter. Once it was secure, a Secret Service agent opened her door and led her toward the building. Another agent moved next to her, his eyes roving at all times. Beckham joined them, moving fast. At the side door to the building, a large man stood with a machine gun resting on his shoulder and a cigarette in his mouth.
Guess your first political rally didn't go so well, huh, boss?
He said to Beckham. It could have been worse, Beckham replied. The man tipped his baseball cap up at Ringgold.
Madam President, very nice to see you tonight.
It was then she saw the face of Master Sergeant Parker Horn.
Good to see you too, Master Sergeant, she said with a faint smile as they strode past.
Horn patted Beckham on the back, but stayed outside, smoking his cigarette and watching the surrounding darkness for threats. The two Secret Service agents continued into the building, leading Ringgold and Beckham into a well-lit hallway. The top floor was being used as a command post for the Iron Hog team of Army Rangers. Crates and boxes were stacked neatly in the hallway. She passed a room they had turned into an operations center. Backtracking, she stopped in the doorway. The former office was full of radio and surveillance equipment. Screens glowed blue over the faces of soldiers sitting there. They were so intent on their work that it took a moment before one of the officers noticed her and shot up at attention. The others all burst up from their seats and stood stiff as boards.
At ease, everyone, she said. I wanted to thank you. I really appreciate you working overtime tonight to make sure the island is secure.
Thank you, Madam President, replied a sergeant.
How's it going, Ruckley? Beckham asked the woman.
Island's locked down, Captain, she said. No one is getting past our defenses.
Ringgold was accustomed to the tired looks of warriors. But there was clearly some resentment in a few gazes tonight. Not that she blamed them. What was happening across the country was too reminiscent of the final nightmarish stages of the Great War of Extinction. Almost as startling, half of the Rangers in this room were in their early 20s, which meant they were hardly even teenagers during that first war. First war, she thought. She backed out of the room. Soprano and one of the agents went inside the office, but she followed Beckham and the rest of the security detail down the stairs to the lab. Until Boston, she hadn't really thought about the possibility of another full-fledged war again. Considering this new reality made her heart thump. She had to find out what was going on, and stop it before it was too late. This way, Madam President, Beckham said. He gestured through an open steel door to the bunker and a living area. They crossed the space and moved into a passage. At the end, glass walls provided a glimpse into a full lab. Kate was working behind the protective glass with Carr and the technicians, but Ringgold's eyes gravitated instantly to a clear fish tank full of what looked like a living hunk of meat in a pink bath of liquid. The red, squirming tissue looked like the heart of a monster.
"What in God's name is that?" she asked.
"Good question," Beckham said. Kate tried to explain it to me, and I still don't think I understand. He hit a button on the wall, buzzing the lab. Everyone inside turned around toward the glass walls. Kate smiled behind her visor and raised a finger to indicate they should wait 1 minute. Ringgold continued scanning the room. Technicians worked at all kinds of equipment, their faces buried in what they were doing. She recognized the microscopes, but was less familiar with the contraptions that had hoses sticking out of them, or the large racks of devices with blinking lights that seemed to be humming. Atop a cart in a corner of the lab, a woman sliced into the exposed muscle of a monstrous limb from an alpha. The technician then took a chunk of what looked like muscle and deposited it into a glass jar. Footsteps sounded back in the bunker hallway, and Ringgold turned to see Soprano speed-walking through the hallway.
"Madam President," he said, panting. I've got news about that collaborator we took into custody at the rally.
What is it?
He gave us the potential location of other collaborators.
Where? Beckham turned to join in the conversation. Luray Caverns in Virginia, Soprano said. SOCOM is already putting together a strike team to check it out.
Beckham looked at Ringgold.
I want on that team. That bastard called me out by name. If this is something personal, I need to be there to stop it.
It's too dangerous, Ringgold replied. Chances are this is a trap. Those caverns could be filled with variants or who knows what else.
Beckham stood straighter and drew in a breath. Madam President, you asked me to run for Senate to protect my country, he said. I can't do that without knowing who these collaborators are.
There are other soldiers to do that, Reed. You already gave more than enough of yourself, Ringgold said.
Please. I promise no live fire. I just want to go for support. I'll bring Big Horn with me.
She had never heard Beckham so insistent on something before. That only reinforced her feeling this was a bad idea. But she trusted him. When it came to military matters, he knew what he was doing.
Okay, she agreed.
More footsteps echoed at the end of the hallway, drawing her attention to what was probably another problem. Two more Rangers joined them, including Sergeant Ruckley. Madam President, we have Vice President Lemke on a line for you, she said, handing over a satellite phone. Ringgold took it in a tired hand. Another call this soon after the first couldn't be because the Vice President wanted to chit-chat.
Talk to me, Dan, she said. Got more bad news. Fisher Fields is under attack.
Ringgold looked back over the lap, the news sinking in. She was hoping for the tycoon's support, but doubted she would get it now.
How about the reinforcements we sent them? Ringgold asked.
I'm not sure they will be enough, Lemke said.
Sounds pretty bad.
Keep me updated.
Yes, Madam President.
Ringgold shook her head and handed the phone back to the sergeant. She had to stop what was happening out there before it spread to every free inch of the Allied States, and they lost everything she had spent the past 8 years trying to rebuild.
19.
The sun dipped on the horizon, disappearing behind the overgrown trees along the Mississippi River. Fitz looked out the window of the Walter Library at the University of Minnesota campus, eyeing the packs of variants hunting outside. Hours ago, the creatures had swarmed the streets, forcing Team Alpha to take cover here. He set up guard shifts so they could all get some sleep while they waited, but Fitz hadn't been able to rest. From the looks of it, his men hadn't fared much better. Ace leaned against the wall next to the window, clearly struggling to keep his eyes open as he watched for threats. Lincoln lay nearby, his head propped up behind his hands on the floor. Fitz wasn't happy about hiding in the mildew-covered building full of rotting books. They needed to get out of there and identify the location of the variants and any prisoners. But roaming packs had forced them into shelter. Added to that, Fitz was on pins and needles not knowing how Team Bravo was doing. He still didn't know if Rico and Dohai had linked up with Mendez yet, or if they were even still alive, for that matter. This was the most difficult part about dating Rico. Not knowing how she was, or if she was hurt. Sometimes he could block out the worry by keeping himself busy, but when the only companion in his mind was boredom, he couldn't help thinking of all the terrible things that might have happened to her. Every second that passed, he considered breaking radio silence, but he decided to trust Rico would transmit if there was an emergency. He checked the window again as the last of the packs moved out of the area. Ace nodded from his location at another window. It was time to move. Fitz nudged Lincoln with a boot. They gathered their gear and headed toward the entryway to the computer lab. Ace led them into the main corridor of the library, passing toppled shelves, bleeding, soggy, mold-covered books. Leaking water from the ceiling pinged on the floor. Somewhere ahead came the scratching and growling of variants. Their rotten fruit odor rose over the pungency of the rotten books. A chill ran through Fitz, and he held up a fist. He suddenly got the sense he made a vital error in judgment, and the variant packs had flanked them. Shadows stretched over the library's floor as several beasts sniffed their way into the room. Lincoln and Ace took cover next to Fitz behind a standing bookshelf.
He watched through a gap in the books as three of the thinnest variants he had ever seen prowled through the shelves, looking for something to eat. They hadn't caught the team's scent yet. Fitz motioned for Lincoln and Ace to hold their fire. One of the creatures picked up a book and then tossed it aside, hitting a second beast. It snapped back and growled, an eye seeming to bulge from a sunken socket. The third beast had stopped to chew on an arm covered in open wounds, oozing blood and pus. The creatures were all covered in bite and scratch marks.
They were cannibalizing one another, he thought.
Fitz maneuvered for a better look, his right blade letting out a slight creak. The munching variant glanced up. The sucker lips snarled back, rows of needle-sharp teeth glistening in saliva. Fitz waited a beat, hoping that the variant would write the noise off and turn away. But he had no such luck. The growling variant crept toward the team. Fitz looked for a quick escape, but with the beasts around them, there would be none. They didn't have any way out of this mess, except... Fitz signaled to Lincoln.
Fuck this,
Lincoln growled. He stepped out from their hiding spot and fired a burst. Rounds punched through the creature's chest, sending it spinning backward. It crashed in a tangled mess of limbs. The remaining two bounded over their dead comrade, each letting out a furious shriek. Lincoln ended their short-lived assault with two more bursts. All three beasts bled out into the pool of rainwater and wet pages of novels that would never be read again. But the damage had been done. The suppressed shots and screeches had attracted the attention of another pack. Fitz didn't need to tell his team to run. Fighting inside the close quarters would be suicide. If they were going to make a stand, they needed a better vantage.
Or you could hide, Fitz thought.
A pair of variants exploded out of a doorway ahead of Ace.
Fight it is, then.
The older man blew off their heads with perfectly aimed shotgun blasts. Other shrieks came from the hallway behind them. Lincoln laid out a wall of cover fire. The crash of metal clanged from the hallway. Fitz followed Lincoln and Ace out to see three more variants vaulting out of a doorway. Windows cracked in the back of the library as other creatures flanked their position. Team Alpha was already surrounded. Ace took on the variants in front, and Lincoln focused on those in back with Fitz. A few got close enough they managed haphazard swipes. Bullets chewed into the diseased flesh of the monsters, dropping them easily. Once they were all down, another flurry of screeches filled the halls.
Changing, Fitz said.
Lincoln slapped in a new magazine and Ace reloaded his rifle. As Fitz charged his rifle, he noticed broken open ceiling tiles and the red webbing they had seen in the tunnels. He signaled for Lincoln and Ace to continue down a stairwell. The group headed toward the bottom floor of the library, where man-made tunnels would lead to other buildings on campus. These had preceded the variants, built for students to transit in warmth during harsh Minnesota winters. Red webbing covered the walls down here, and the scent of carrion intensified. The variants had made themselves at home. Fitz ran onto a dirt-covered floor and looked over his shoulder at the stairs. They had to flick on their tack lights to pierce the suffocating darkness. The roars of the variants boomed from the upper floors of the library. He whirled to scan the basement. Growls and grunts came from across the dark space. The noises sounded like there was something more than the garden variety variants occupying this area. He identified the familiar high-pitched staccato notes and an ear-splitting clicking that the alphas made. Now he wondered if it was the noise they had made that drew all of the packs, or if it was this creature commanding them like some crazed conductor. If that was the case, then they wouldn't be able to escape the constant barrage of attacks until the Alpha was dead. They had to take it down. Fitz signaled toward the man-made tunnel that led from the bottom floor of the library to neighboring university buildings. The webbing was dense here, some of it stretching across the passage. Other variant-made tunnels branched off the main passage, more of the webbing coating the dirt and rock walls like cobwebs. Clicking joints echoed, preventing Fitz from getting a good read on the location of the other packs. He knew one thing. They were coming for Alpha Team. The soldiers pressed deeper into another passage where he finally saw movement. A massive shape lumbered down the dark corridor.
That's the Alpha, Fitz whispered to his team members.
Lincoln aimed his rifle, but the abomination rounded a corner. A flood of smaller variants suddenly rushed in to cover their leader's escape. Lincoln took a knee, and Ace hugged the wall. Fitz moved between them to get an open firing zone in the narrow passage. The sinewy monsters crashed under the wave of gunfire, clogging the tunnel with bodies.
"Conserve your ammo!" Fitz yelled.
He had already gone through several magazines, and only had four left, plus his sidearm, and they still hadn't collected the intel they needed to relay to command. They had to get out of here. He turned, seeing more shadows moving in the space. Dread filled his gut. In an effort to try and escape, he had trapped them down here in a network of variant-infested tunnels.
Shit, shit. Stay focused. Stay calm. All it takes is all you got, Fitz.
As the Alpha variant escaped, it seemed to be sending more variants at Team Ghost. Suddenly, one of the creatures pounced from a branching tunnel and rammed into Lincoln. He crashed to the ground, pushing up at the beast as the wormy lips peeled back, saliva roping off its teeth onto Lincoln's face. Fitz grabbed its head and twisted it with a violent snap. The claws meant for Lincoln's face slid along the floor, tearing into the pulsing webs of tissue.
"Thanks," Lincoln said as he rose with Fitz's help.
Turning to fire, rounds and shotgun blasts chewed into more variants advancing on them. Almost as soon as they finished off that batch, another creature exploded out of the darkness. Lincoln cut it down with a flurry of rounds that sent it sliding across the web-covered floor. Fitz motioned for them to head into a branching tunnel, trying to find a way out before the Alpha could send another wave. They needed something to change the paradigm. It took him a few minutes of running for his mind to think back to Outpost Turkey River, and that gave him an idea. The R2TD system had attracted the Alpha, which it seemed more interested in destroying that piece of equipment than any of the humans around it. From what Fitz knew, the beast used echolocation to navigate through its environment. Those huge bat-like ears were hypersensitive to sound, and the pings of the R2TD device must be in the right frequency range for the beast to pick it up. More variants hurled themselves out of neighboring tunnels ahead, and Fitz stopped to take them down. He yelled while firing,
"Activate the R2TD system!"
"What?" Ace shouted back.
"Turn it on!" Fitz screamed. "Lincoln and I will lay down cover and fire."
"You fucking crazy? If you want to get out of here, do it!"
Ace took off the device and flipped it on. A low hum emanated from the machine as they waited for the next pack of monsters. Instead of the squawks from the grunts, a roar blasted from one of the nearby tunnels. The sound of footsteps echoed as the creature was drawn to the machine like a bug to a light.
"Where's it coming from?" Lincoln said.
Fitz turned just in time to see a giant shape filling the wide corridor.
"Behind us," he said.
The Alpha ran at a hunch, bat-like ears fanning out the sides of its head. The muscular arms pumped as it moved, and the spindles of tissue stuck out of its spine toward the surface of the webbing on all sides of the tunnel. The three men opened up on it with their weapons. Rounds blew out hunks of meat, slowing the advancing monster. It stumbled under the hail of lead, letting out a series of pained screams. It made it a few more strides before collapsing to the ground. Using its claws, it dragged its broken body toward them. Fitz lined up his aiming reticles over the creature's bulbous head. A final shot blasted away the bone and flesh of the creature's blind face. For a moment, Fitz thought he had a chance to gather his breath again. But new sounds boomed down the tunnels. More Alphas. A new trickle of adrenaline surged through his vessels. Fitz signaled for Ace to set the R2TD system down. The device would attract all the nearby Alphas. He had only intended to eliminate the one, but if they could clear out more, then he would take that opportunity. The questions were how many more they would have to take out, and did they have enough ammo? Another beast lumbered into the tunnel with hands clamped over its ears. It let out a pained howl that was answered by the boom of Ace's shotgun. The abomination crashed not far from the first. Another Alpha joined the fight, then a third and a fourth.
Holy shit, Fitz thought.
He hadn't expected so many of the beasts to be prowling these tunnels under Minneapolis. It only proved to him that this place was important, undoubtedly an epicenter of variant activity. By the time Fitz directed Ace to turn the R2TD off, seven corpses clogged the tunnels. The clicking of joints and shrieks seemed to retreat.
"Let's get out of here,"
Lincoln whispered. Ace picked up the dormant R2TD system, and Fitz used the back of his hand to clean flecks of blood from his face. He took point and led them back to the main tunnel system. Other tunnels intersected with the sides of the main corridor. Fitz spotted the desiccated remains of animals in several of them. Everything big and small had been strung up, sharing a fate like those deer they'd seen in Duluth. In some instances, Fitz even saw dead variants hanging from the red webbing. Whatever this stuff was, it pulsed more wildly here. Fitz could practically feel the electricity coming off it and into his own skin. The deeper into the main tunnel system they went, the faster his heartbeat, as if his own body knew what he was heading into before he did. After using the R2TD weapon like that, he was certain that they had taken out all the alphas within a generous area from their location. If his memory served him correctly, they were nearing the Northrop Performing Arts Center. The air became more humid the deeper they moved. Advancing through these tunnels seemed like walking through the blood vessels of some giant beast. Fitz realized that wasn't so far from the truth. The tunnels were, in a way, part of a living monster, and the Delta operators were like parasites. These growths of living tissue seemed to be the way the monsters organized themselves, creating a kind of hive-mind network. He didn't know exactly how it worked, but he had a feeling they were getting close to uncovering that secret based on the ferocity of the variant defenses they had encountered. He balled his fist as a deep roar boomed in the distance. The thunderous voice rattled his bones, resonating in his marrow. Lincoln and Ace both had their hands on their helmets, staggering back and forth until the sound died away. Fitz brought up his rifle, trying to blink away the stars bursting before his vision. "What was that?" he stammered. Ace shook his helmet. "I don't know, and I don't want to find out." Lincoln shrugged and shouldered his rifle. "If something's gonna try to kill us down here, I'd rather get this shit over with." Kate rolled over in bed, instinctively reaching out for Beckham and feeling nothing but sheets. She shot up, remembering that he had left shortly after midnight for the USS George Johnson. "I'm just going to monitor the mission and will only go in after the team has confirmed it safe," he had said. Horn had gone with him, entrusting her security and the kids with Sergeant Ruckley and her Army Rangers, as well as the Marines. Kate got out of bed and walked over to the window, taking in a deep breath of the crisp morning air drifting into the temporary housing. Letting out a yawn, she went to her bag of clothes. She had slept, but not well, since Beckham was gone. With the end of the Great War of Extinction, she had gotten used to seeing him every day and feeling the warmth of his body at night. For the past few weeks, she hadn't seen much of him at all, and she feared that wasn't going to change any time soon, especially with the new scientific studies she was embarking on and his decision to take on a role with the government. It seemed their quiet lifestyle on the island had come to an end. "Mom," Javier said, rubbing his eyes in the doorway.
"Do you have to work again?"
"Yes, honey, I'm sorry." Javier frowned.
"When is Dad coming back?"
"Soon."
"I want to go home," Javier sighed. "I don't like this place."
"Don't you like hanging out with the other kids?"
"I guess. But Timothy seems really mad, and so does Bo."
"I imagine it's going to be hard for Timothy for a while. Just keep trying to be there for him, okay?" Javier nodded.
"He does like playing with Ginger and Spark."
"Good. You guys should take them to the park and play today."
"Okay,"
Javier said, his spirit lifting.
"As long as Tasha and Jenny are cool with it, maybe they'll want to play soldier with me."
Kate nearly winced.
"Why don't you play scientists instead?" Kate asked.
"You know, some of us are quite happy as scientists." Javier sunk his hands into his pockets.
"If I don't become a soldier, then I'll be a scientist," he said. "I just want to help when I get older."
Kate smiled at that.
"You can start by helping Timothy and being there for him in his time of need."
"I know,
and I will."
Javier went back to his room to get ready for the day. When she was good to go, she started a pot of coffee. While she waited for it to brew, she watched Javier eat his breakfast, wondering what his future might hold. Her gut told her his future might very well be decided in the next several days by scientists and soldiers. One of them waited outside her door now.
"Morning, doctor," said Michael.
The fit young soldier raised a fist and Javier pounded it.
"Hey, Mikey," Javier said.
"Sup, champ?"
"Not much. Just another boring day ahead."
"Tell me about it."
Michael glanced at Kate.
"No offense, doctor."
She smiled and walked down to Donna's room, stopping to knock. Turning back, she kissed Javier and gave him a hug.
"Have a good day, honey."
Donna stepped out of her room at that moment with a smile aimed at Kate.
"Don't worry," she said. "I'll take good care of him."
"I know you will." "Thanks, Donna," Kate replied. Michael led her downstairs where a full escort of soldiers waited in the hotel lobby. Security had been tight since the raid on Peaks Island and Portland. Because Ringgold had identified her and Carr as VIPs, they could barely use a bathroom without having to check in with someone. A Humvee took her to the piers, and a private boat took her to Peaks Island and the lab. Carr was already working, his eyes pressed against a microscope within the cell culture room. Kate donned a white bunny suit, mask, and goggles, then stepped into the lab. The familiar chorus of chirping and humming laboratory equipment greeted her. Lab techs filtered in and out. The team that Carr had arrived with was big enough to keep the place staffed 24 hours a day. It bumped up their productivity and allowed Kate a night of rest so desperately needed without feeling too guilty. One of the techs handed Kate a summary of the experiments they'd conducted through the night.
"Anything particularly interesting I should be looking at?" Kate asked, beginning to skim the report.
"The cells tested positive for cancer markers," the tech replied.
"Huh? That certainly helps explain the unrestrained growth of the cells and why the vessels feeding the tissues are so patchy."
The tech nodded and walked away. Kate took the report with her to where Carr worked, trying to wrap her mind around the implications of these new findings. Oftentimes, in tumors, blood vessels grew too fast to form properly. Instead of allowing blood to flow through them normally like a garden hose, vessels growing in tumors acted more like those sprinkler hoses with all the tiny holes in them used to water lawns. But that didn't help her to understand why they couldn't get the masses of tissues in their bioreactors and cell culture plates to form the same organized webbing structures that Team Ghost had seen in the tunnels.
"Good morning, Dr. Lovato," Carr said when she joined him at the microscope. "I trust you've read the most recent data."
"I have, and what it tells me is that we've still got a long way to go."
"That we do."
He sighed and turned to look at her.
"I've tried making sense of the phenotypic data in comparison with the abhorrent bulk behavior of the tissue, but it just doesn't fit together."
"What have you tried since I was gone?"
Carr pulled out the cell culture plate he'd been examining on the microscope tray.
"I'm incubating tissue samples from the autopsied alpha with the webbing samples. Mind if I take a look?"
"Be my guest."
Carr replaced the cell culture plate, and Kate pressed her face to the eyepieces. The nerve and muscle cells from the webbing were a disorganized mess. They certainly looked like the cancerous mass that the tech had reported they were. But, on the other side of the dish, separated by a thin, semi-permeable membrane, the cells isolated from the autopsied alpha spindle were still growing. They appeared neat and organized, stretching in long networks like the nerve and muscle cells Kate would have expected in mature, healthy tissue. The cells appeared to be doing exactly what they were supposed to do, as if something was directing their growth. It hit Kate, maybe that was exactly what was happening. If so, she had been looking at things backward.
"Let's have the team run GT-PACE activity assays on these samples," Kate said. "I want to know the signaling activity levels in both cell populations."
"I don't know if..."
"We ran your experiments with the alpha spindle, and they didn't work," Kate said, looking over at Carr, who stood by her shoulder. "It's time to try something else."
Carr gave the order to the techs. They started running the assays in the other part of the lab. If the results proved her instincts right, then they were going to have to adjust their understanding of the cellular interactions they thought had been dictating the tissue behavior so far. It took a couple of hours,
and once the experiments had completed, Kate and Carr studied the results on a computer monitor. The staff had already analyzed the data and transferred it to graphs that showed the relationship Kate had been expecting.
"My goodness, this is not what I expected," Carr said. "Increased GT pace activity indicates higher levels of cell signaling with an especially high concentration going on in the webbing cells," Kate stated.
"I can see that. What's strange to me is that there is far less signaling going on in the spindle cells."
"Precisely," Kate said. "My guess is that the cell signaling is stronger in the webbing because the alpha spindles function differently than we expected. The spindles are more like an old TV's antenna than a radio station's antenna."
"You mean they're meant for receiving signals instead of transmitting them?"
"Yes. The GT pace activity is just as high in the webbing in dishes that both have and don't have the spindle cells," Kate continued. "If you look at a cell culture that only has spindle cells, there is very little GT pace activity, meaning the alpha spindle cells don't do anything without signals from the webbing cells."
"That certainly supports your hypothesis." Carr gestured to one of the larger bioreactors with the masses of tissue growing in them.
"Guess it's time to take these tests to the next level."
Kate nodded and helped carry one of the football-sized clear tanks and the webbing tissue to a table in the middle of the cell culture room. Carr set up one of the alpha spindles like they did last time, complete with a controller to apply voltages to the tissue. This time, he set the electrode to apply an electrical field to the webbing tissue instead of the alpha spindle.
"Ready?" he asked.
She nodded. He turned on the controller. Kate held her breath, anxious to see if she was right. The invisible current of electricity passed through the mass of webbing tissue, and unlike the other tests, it didn't bubble or expand. Instead, it pulsed evenly, like a heartbeat. At the other end of the bioreactor, connected to those webbing tissues, was the alpha spindle attached through a port in the bioreactor. The spindle seemed to contract smoothly and didn't quiver or jump around like a fish on land. Even when Carr pressed their luck by increasing the voltage, the tissues continued to perform the same way. There appeared to be little difference in the behavior of the different tissues.
"It's working," Carr said, as a smile slowly started to spread across his face.
"You're right. Whatever signals are being transmitted through the webbing are passing through the alpha spindle. And this time, nothing appears to be going crazy."
"This is how the tissues are supposed to behave.
So the alpha is taking signals from the webbing, but the webbing tissues haven't changed form at all. It's still a mess, instead of self-organizing into the spiderweb tendrils."
Kate frowned. "That's what I was afraid of. We've only got half the equation here."
"There must be something else that transmits commands through the webbing." Carr seemed to think on it for a moment before turning to look at Kate.
"I don't think the alphas are at the top of the food chain, Dr. Lovato."
"I think you're right. All this reminds me of the monsters from Europe that had morphed into bug and reptile-like creatures. They had fairly complex social structures."
"If there was something else out there that could control the alphas and coordinating variants and collaborators, it had to be more intelligent and frightening than anything they had encountered yet."
Her stomach sank.